Welcome back, one and all, to Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And this week on the pod, we have one of my favorite people. I love talking to this lady. Anytime I've been lucky enough to sit in a bar after a show with this woman, it's always a fascinating, funny, great conversation. And she's just one of those people who makes you feel special when she talks to you. Her name is Lisa Berry, and she is one of the artists involved in an incredibly exciting new project called 21 Black Futures that has been put on, that is now streaming on CBC Gem, and comes from Obsidian Theatre, which is Toronto's black theatre company. So it's 21 black artists, 21 black playwrights, 21 black actors, and 21 black directors that have created one-person pieces about the future of Canadian blackness. I've been watching it all morning, and one of the things that struck me, Ali, is like, woo, like production values.
It's unbelievable.
We've come a long way from our first Zoom readings of, you know, Harold Pinter plays between each other when this all started in last March.
You've heard of the Pinter pause. There's the Zoom lag, which is...
yeah, exactly. That's why doing Pinter on Zoom works. It looks gorgeous. I can't believe how quickly this was all pulled together. I mean, it's quite a mammoth task. And Lisa's a huge part of it. And so we're going to talk to her about that project, but also about, as we try to on this podcast, how to get through all of this. Lisa's a powerfully positive human being and has worked very hard over the years that I've known her as a person, not just as an artist, but as a thinker about how she wants to approach her life. And during the end of the talk we had with her, that we're going to play you soon, there's some really beautiful words about like how to get through this and how to make it and have some sense of self intact. So that's coming up. Lisa Berry on Soft Revolution is going to be a great chat. Stick around for that. But first, inevitably, the news. And, I wish we didn't have to talk about the news, people. I wish we could just discuss, whether or not the Oscars still matter. They don't, in parentheses. whether or not the Tonys still matter. They don't. We can't talk about that because the news is like just this eternal hurricane of shit that just keeps blowing against your face until you feel like you're just going to drown in shit.
Yeah.
Ali Moman, what's been catching your mind this week world of news?
So running for office.
Yeah, how's that going?
I will tell you, all it does is it makes you think about the future and how to fix things. So yes, it frustrates you. Yes, you go, man, so many politicians are not actually thinking about what they should be thinking about. So many politicians have an idea that, we are polar bears that are just going to go inside, hibernate, and come out, or grizzly bears, and come out, and everything is going to be the same. And I am just, I am not that guy. I am thinking about the future. I'm thinking about how we get out of here. So I receive the news, but now I digest it as like, hey, there's something maybe that I can do about this news. Yes.
Right.
And so here's the lesson, guys. Get involved. I'm going to keep on saying this. Get involved. Get involved. Politics is poly. It's the people. And you know what? Get in the arena. It is an incredible thing. I suggest it. Not enough people vote. Not enough people get angry, but not enough people do anything about it. And here's this like really crazy thing about politics, about voting that just like, it's like, not now. It's the thing that I'm trying to tackle and understand. We especially young people, right? You could get like thousands of young people out for like a climate change rally, out for a BLM protest. But then you're like, hey, do you want to come and vote? They don't vote. What the fuck?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with their lack of trust in the party political system. And
we got to change that. And hopefully I could do something.
Yeah. Well, I think it's people like you getting involved is a key factor to changing that equation, because I think, the difference between, there shouldn't be such a thing as a career politician, right? There shouldn't be such a thing as a person who has not known any other life like Stephen Harper or Andrew Scheer, who's not known any other life than being a politician in their life, because then they start making decisions predicated on maintaining their career instead of doing what they came to do, which is change things. And I think that's why it's, you know, quite apart from artists getting involved in politics, truck drivers and frontline workers and nurses and normal human beings need to get involved in politics, because it shouldn't be a career. It should be a calling that you go to when you feel like there's something happening that you want to do something about. But, you know, you're talking about how to get out of this. That brings me to the first thing I wanted to ask you about this week, because you are my amateur epidemiologist. You are,
I am.
Well, you're the only sane person I talk to on a weekly basis, because the rest of the people I talk to are all musicians, and God knows none of them have anything resembling a rational thought in their heads. Yeah. So you're talking about how to get out of this, and I'm feeling like we're in this moment of, and I talked a bit about this last week, of real dissonance and shattering in terms of the narrative right now, because people are feeling very confused, including myself, I think. We are seeing cases dropping around the world for the first time, in some places precipitously, and they don't seem connected to mask mandates or to lockdowns necessarily or to vaccine distribution. You can look at places like South Africa, or Britain, or, you know, things are changing. Nobody seems to be quite clear on why, but it's hopeful. And yet you have this other sort of narrative happening, this parallel narrative, which is we are being warned by epidemiologists in a pretty much a broad consensus that these variants, B.1.1.7 in particular, are virulent and are dangerous, and we are about to spiral. Mm-hmm. How do we make sense of those two dissonant narratives?
This has been one of the big things, is realizing that for many places, this has truly been a communications, I'm not going to say nightmare, I'm actually going to say a true communications challenge, because you have this very novel thing, you have this thing that is profoundly complex, and then you have a multitude of echo chambers to deal with. And getting the proper information out correctly, if you were the only voice, is hard enough, let alone when you have, as you say, armchair epidemiologists, people who like are literally having private kind of debates about stuff in public on social media and stuff.
Right.
And it's deeply, deeply confusing. And sifting through all the facts and the stuff is really difficult. In terms of just everything that I've read and the conclusions that I could gather. Yeah, you know, cases are going down. And you mentioned England, but, you know, England is still in, they're not going to school until March 8th. Like, they're continuing the lockdown. So numbers are going down because of, you know, non-pharmaceutical interventions, because of lockdowns. But yes, cases are going down. But we were talking about this before. The number that is actually the most important, more important than case numbers, even more important than case positivity, is the R-naught. Is for each case of COVID, how many people does that individual give COVID to? And the thing about this variant is that right now, even though our cases are low in Ontario comparatively than when we started our lockdown, the R-naught is high. So people are just, in general, far more transmissible and giving it to more people. And again, it's like, this is exponential math. It just is what it is. It's you just multiply. So that's why people are kind of worrisome. I think what the goal is, really, is we need to get to a point where it's not freezing out. And we need to be able to get to a point where if people engage, we can encourage it to be as outside as possible. Unfortunately, now asking people to engage is asking them to engage in the most virulent of ways. And that is, unfortunately, a challenge. It's hard, though. You know what? Summer is coming, though, guys.
Yeah, I mean,
summer is coming. And I want to say one thing before you go to your thing. You sent me this is why communication is important. You sent me this article, I think it was from The Guardian, and the headline was that Boris Johnson says that social distancing will continue until the fall. And you're like, this is bullshit.
Till next year.
Till next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it said the fall or something.
Well,
but
yeah.
That's what it said. But I was like, you know, we need to figure out how we talk to people. Rather than saying that, I think you're better off saying, look, social distancing will end in the fall. And more importantly, don't give people all or nothing thinking. When you say social distancing will do something, you're letting people know a very that you're making people feel like it's very binary, like it's on and off. You're not giving people the stages and the steps. And again, I talk about Australia, but when they did their crazy lockdown, that was intense. That is bringing them Come From Away and Moulin Rouge, and people are having a great time over there, guys. They were very clear about benchmarks over there. It was a communications success story over there.
So, well, this virus is a one of the many nightmarish aspects of it is how it meets digital culture and how it meets digital news culture. And, you know, the fact that everyone gets their news essentially by reading headlines and then not clicking on the article is a perfect storm in terms of misinformation around this virus, because it is not something you can explain in a single sentence often. It's not something you can even explain in five paragraphs quite a lot of the time. And one of those things that I've been thinking a lot about, because whatever happens with these variants, on some level, to some degree, it is all noise, because the trajectory ultimately doesn't really change, right? Pandemics end. This pandemic will, whether it's through this variant or some other variant, burn itself out, or we will vaccinate to the point where it doesn't have as much power over us. So once that happens, and that will be, relatively speaking, soon, this is, to me, the big, big question, and this is particularly the big question for arts and culture, is risk assessment. We are going to have to start, as individuals and as a society, to begin to change our thoughts about what real risk assessment is. There's a very good article, a Substack newsletter by an economist called Emily Oster. We'll put up a link to it after the show, in which she talks very, very lucidly about this. Once, you know, because everyone's hearing, well, the vaccine doesn't change anything. Once you get your vaccine, you still can't hug your grandmother. You still have to wear masks, blah, 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 blah. She kind of mathematically takes you through various scenarios which you might meet in the coming months and changes those different factors within that scenario, i.e., is everyone vaccinated? Or is only one group of people vaccinated? Is everyone wearing masks? Is everyone not wearing masks? Are you in a basement? Are you outside? That's the thing about saying once you've been vaccinated, nothing changes. It's not true.
It's not true.
Nor is it true to say once you've been vaccinated, everything changes.
Not true.
So finding a way to express nuanced, subtle, complicated, math-based health policy.
Yeah, it's a communications challenge, right?
It's not a messaging challenge that, in my opinion, should be left to people who've spent their lives in laboratories not talking to other people. It should be left to people who know how to talk to people. They should take the information that the scientists have given them and then work with the scientists to message that in a way that normal human beings can grasp. But one of the things...
Yeah, because I was just saying before you continue, because Fauci's skill is, of course, that he's a great scientist, but Fauci also has a high level of EQ.
Yes.
He's able to talk to people.
Yes.
I think people mistake this about Fauci. They go, listen to the scientists. Listen to Dr. Fauci. Yeah, Dr. Fauci. He's very good with words. But not everyone.
No,
not
he's
everyone.
Not. He's a Brooklyn boy and it
tells. Yeah, he's a cool, like, just some guy telling me, like, some shit. And by the way, here's a guy curing HIV. It's unbelievable.
Here's the thing that this article basically says. It's what she gets to is this. Once you have been vaccinated, your risk is vanishingly low of giving this thing to other people. So that will be scientifically established in the coming months. That is what everybody who knows what they're talking about says, is that in all likelihood, with next to near certainty, vaccines will reduce transmission. Vaccines will reduce severe illness to the point where this disease becomes endemic, but dealable with in much the same way that the flu or TB or any number of other things is dealable with. At that point, we as cultural workers have got to face the fact that we are not going to walk into a zero risk situation. And we can never expect to be in a zero risk situation. And there has been we've all been traumatized by fear. This thing is terrifying. You know, you might just get the sniffles, but you might have it for 6 months and not be able to think straight. It's a terrifying virus. It will exist out there for some time to come. Does that mean we shouldn't cram people into a theater post-vaccine? No, it doesn't. because at some point life is about calculated risk. And so I want for conversation around risk to not become, to become less binary. Right now, there's a lot of virtue signaling. There's a lot of people scoring points on each other about their COVID absolutism and their COVID orthodoxy to public health guidelines. And that's a good thing. That was important that we hammer, wear a mask, stay safe, wash your hands, blah, blah, blah. Those things are now endemic in our society. Those are rules which we've all come to. Now we got to start to think about how to move away from those rules safely. And I think that's a much bigger and much more subtle conversation. And I'm wondering what you think, as someone who's running for political office, how are you going to tell people you can get the vaccine, not because life will change immediately in all ways, but because life will change in some really crucial ways immediately?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is being able to communicate the tiered status of coming back. I think the biggest mistake that we make as humans, and we have made as policymakers, and we have made as politicians, not everybody, but I something I say, it's like no light switch talk. No light switch talk. The notion that, you know, there's going to be a moment where you switch a light and we're back, that has to stop. And we need to gear our entire communication strategy to that, that it's going to be a tiered progression towards normalcy. Normalcy is the big thing.
Okay.
And the other thing is like,
Wait a minute. No, because you just struck me. I don't want to lose it. So you just said normalcy. Don't you think that it's important now to tell people, let's just talk about art, okay? Because that's what we're here to do. Yes, we will fill theaters again. There is no expectation. There is no world in which we cannot fill theaters again.
Yeah, 100%.
That's not normal. It's not going to work economically. It doesn't work in terms of human biology. It's
what if I said, yes, we're going to fill theaters again. We're going to be at a point where it doesn't matter even if you have vaccination papers to fly. Who knows when that's going to be? You know, and every country is going to be different. There are certain places, like if you want to go to Mecca and you want to do the pilgrimage, you know, you got to have it all. You got to have that laid down, you know, so that's coming back. But I think people don't know that it's not coming back in a light switch is all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is like, Torque, even if it was a light switch, let's say there is a light switch and government public health just says, forget it. You know what? Do whatever you want, fam. It's still going to be difficult to cram 1,000 people because we don't forcibly cram people. Sometimes you can't get 30% to fill a house anyways.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like this idea that all of a sudden people are just going to run back in, sure. But there are also a lot of people are going to be like, let me like dip my toes in the water first. Let me see what's up. Let me see how it's going. It's just going to take time. But if anybody, if any artist, if anyone here is thinking that we are never going back to sweating up beside somebody, I promise you it is happening. But there's going to be a march towards it. There's going to be a little march towards it.
Let me ask you this. As you talk to politicos now and you're starting to talk to people in the political world about building a platform, et cetera, and you're getting to know what your particular party will and won't stand for. When you raise the issues that we've been talking about on Soft Revolution for the past year, when you talk about creativity in public policy, when you talk about the arts as a foundational aspect of reviving cities, do they look at you funny? Or are you getting a sense that they understand that?
It's a communications game. It's about facts and stats. And it's about, you know, telling people, for me in general, I always like to view things like, how can I express this not as a give, but as a get? So when I speak about, for instance, you know, the contribution of culture, I always make sure to say 650,000 jobs, 3% GDP, each job begets 3.8 jobs. And so when I speak about one of the ideas that I have is to be like, look, this work from home thing is going, I talk about it all the time. I'm smelling it, you know? It's going to continue in perpetuity. It's going to be around. And on top of that, you know, like it or not, Apple's coming out with some mixed reality glasses, augmented reality, virtual reality. It's going to be some cool stuff. You're probably going to be able to put some goggles on one day in the near future and actually have a friend seem like they're sitting in your living room. Crazy stuff. It's coming. Now, what I do say, though, is that for our economies to thrive locally, not have it run just by big tech, not have a restaurant suffer while Silicon Valley DoorDash, Silicon Valley Uber is making hand over fist, is that we need to encourage human beings to put down their device and engage in life. And that is what we need to do. And for me, that's why I push the arts and culture as a means to get that to happen. But you have to speak in terms of money.
What I'm asking is, do you sense an acknowledgement in the political class that there isn't a future for cities in particular without a future for night culture?
When you express it, they understand it. There's no way to listen. There's debate about how to do everything. Everyone has different ideas. It seems that our provincial government in Ontario has an idea, has the light switch thinking. And that's the type of thinking that needs to be eradicated. The notion that, like, you know what, we're going to get through this and then it's going to come back the way it is. Look, I think Doug Ford doesn't even know how to use his BlackBerry from like 2009. Now, to some people, that's cute. To some people, that's quite folksy and it fits with his, you know, but to me, that's very concerning. That's very, very concerning. but no, the argument is, and this is something I will tell all the artists, when you're advocating for yourself, you have to advocate on the notion of the intelligent action that, hey, this thing is both good for me and is good for you. Conservatives do it all the time. Conservatives have been able to push this notion that trickle-down economics, that you give money to a rich person and, you know, you fill their pockets, it's going to be great for society because it's going to trickle down. That is demonstrably wrong.
Untrue. Yeah.
It's untrue. All the data and the facts is there to suggest that to be baloney, but nevertheless, they say it. But the crux of that argument is something that we should all be considering and learning. So if you want to become like an advocate for anything, guys, there's a lot of literature out there. For instance, I'll tell you this one thing that we're advocating for is we're pushing, you know, quality, affordable, and available childcare. Very big deal, right? But if I just go to somebody, quality, affordable, and available childcare, they go, But then you go, wait, if women participate as equally as men in the workforce, that's $100 billion extra a year into the economy. Corporations that have 10% or more female participation in management, 24% more economic output, 47% greater dividend. So, you know, when I talk to the really good politicians, the ones who have been able to make really good change and the ones who have been able to do things, at the end of the day, it's understanding the thing that we understand, that your show could be really great, but if the audience doesn't like it, they're not going to come. Mm-hmm. They're not going to come. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but yes, when I feel like I'm making inroads to for them to recognize that, pack the galleries, pack the concert halls, pack the museums, pack the theaters, and what you will get is you will get packed restaurants again, you will get packed cafes again, you will get packed bars again, you will get packed stores again, because otherwise you're competing with FANG, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google.
Right.
And we who's going to win? FANG.
We're never going to win that. We're never going to win that fight.
Never going to win it.
I mean, you can see, and we're going to get to Lisa so that we can have some more cheerful conversation about the future of the performing arts. But this week, in some fairly local but devastating news, Le Select, which is a legendary French bistro in Toronto that's been around for 35, 40 years, literally my favorite restaurant on planet Earth, has announced that it's been bought by a real estate company and is shutting down. And the National Theatre, I just was reading in The Guardian, is ending its European touring because the new Brexit rules make it impossible for them to tour over there. There does seem to be this incredibly dangerous lag in the political class understanding the importance of culture coming back from all this and their ability to enact anything, to do anything about it. And I see extinction all around us, folks. And I don't think we can run from that anymore. I think we've done our 5 stages of grieving. And the truth of the matter is we will be starting from zero coming back from this.
So
in
what
many
comes from
respects.
The ashes? What comes from the ashes? I was going to ask you a question. I put this on a note. You met a thing. You're like, you know, Coachella's not going to be back. And that. Okay, let's say Coachella's not back.
Yeah.
Are things going to take the place? See, my worry, and this is why I think about the digitalized life, the digital present, is my worry is that people are going to be satisfied enough for enough of their time that it's going to be difficult to get back to that culture. That's what I worry about. But the notion of concerts coming back, they will come back, theaters coming back. But what do you think? Like, what rises from the ashes?
That worries me a great deal too. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about, well, after the last flu pandemic, there was the Roaring Twenties, but the Roaring Twenties didn't happen when big tech and disaster capitalism had a vested interest in keeping everybody at home stuck to their computer screens, right? Like, the billionaires have become trillionaires during all of this. And there are many people moving in society trying to make big bucks off of whom this is a good circumstance. They now have a populace just where they want them. So the Roaring Twenties happened because people couldn't sit at home and watch Netflix. And so you're right, Ali. I think there is a huge lift ahead of us to try and get people to understand that if they don't support culture and if they don't make culture part of their lives again, they're going to look at a diminished tax base. They're going to look at a diminished community. They're going to look at a diminished educational system and a diminished future for their children. So it's not just about going out and eating at a restaurant or going to see a show at a club because you want to. It's about actually creating the future that you want to see for your children is not just going to be about, you know, being ecologically smart and starting to, you know, use less carbon and all those things that are going to fight climate change. We now have a cultural extinction event that we have to fight by being self-consciously outward looking in our consumption of culture. We have got to take it upon ourselves to, and this is what I mean about risk assessment. We can't do that if we're living in fear of this virus. We have got to get to a place where we're willing to accept that this virus is going to circulate, that we are, in all likelihood, going to get on top of it to the point where it won't affect very many people, but it will affect a few. And we have got to accept as cultural workers that the danger of us no longer existing is a greater danger than the danger of a few people getting sick from COVID-19. And that's not an easy sell. That's not an easy place to get to, especially for artists.
I think you're making it more, honestly, Torque, I think you're making it more complicated because this applies not just to artists. This applies to restaurants. This applies to shopping. Yeah. Every kind of business or activity or endeavor that isn't done with bits and bytes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we need to realize that, you know, while it may, as an artist, we may seem like we're alone. When I'm starting to sound like a politician. When I talk to the constituents, but no, when I actually speak, when you actually speak to people who own a small business and who are worried about, you know, whether or not they're going to be able to, you know, come back,
survive.
From it, they're no different than us.
No,
you know. So this is something that everybody is thinking about, and this is something that we all have to figure out how we're going to get through. But listen, we're going to get through. We will be back together again. Right now, as I say, it's shitty out. It's cold out. The variants are out. We don't got the vaccines as much as we want, but they are indeed coming. There's good news even here in Canada that's starting to percolate about the vaccines. We are, and I want to remind people, don't forget when this thing first started, Dr. Fauci, Bill Gates, they told us 18 months to get a vaccine, which means that would have been September of 2021 for its arrival. We got it in December. We should be very, very fucking fortunate about that fact. I know we're running a little bit late, but I do have one policy idea, and I want to know what you think about it. Right now, if I wanted to go, let's say, I'm going to say Crow's Theater, you know, we're in residence. If I wanted to give Crow's Theater $1,000 as a donation, I'm going to get a tax receipt for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I wanted to spend $1,000 of seeing Crow's Theater, I get nothing. Now I get the show.
Right.
And that's really great. But I say to myself, you know, we need to kind of incentivize people to hustle and bustle out of their homes. And wouldn't it be great if every Ontarioan had the ability, or this could apply to anywhere else, had the ability to maybe like $100 individual, $150, $200 that could be used towards a non-for-profit or for-profit cultural institution. You could create a list of places where it's applicable, especially if it's local.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I think that's a good idea. Get people out and expose people to shit that they don't even probably know about.
And I'll add to that, I think that is an absolutely essential thing to do and so easy, and it doesn't cost any money. It's just about giving people money into their pockets to spend on culture. I also think that on top of that, there needs to be a discussion about whether there should be tax-free art zones. In other words, if you are a landlord with an empty space downtown that used to be occupied by a business or by an office space, if you let that space out to a cultural worker, to an arts organization, or to an artist, you don't have to pay property tax on that property. As long as an artist is in that property, you're not paying property tax, right?
That's something that
they've been doing in Europe to great effect. And I think that there is a lot of potential in that, especially given that the downtown core of a lot of cities is going to be very vacant. And we're going to need to fill those places.
How are we going to fill the space? And spaces that at the end of the day with one objective, get you out of the house.
That's right. Yeah.
We are. I don't want to say we're at war with big tech, but if we want our local economies to thrive, we have to be able to be at least a really great alternative. Right now, we have this thing about shop local, for instance, right?
Yep.
This whole thing about shop local to me is, I get it. It is the right thing to do. Shop local as much as possible. But shopping local cannot just be an act of altruism. Shopping local has to be more than that. It has to be both combine community and convenience. And how do we do that? How do we make sure businesses and cultural institutions are able to be, you know, able to thrive in a hybrid digital real life world?
And there's
There's
an element too of self-interest in that. And Killer Mike talks a lot about this in terms of the Black community. I think there's a lot to be gained from how the Black community are tackling their economic devastation in the United States, which was put in place by 200 years of racism. But they are in many ways in the same situation as the cultural sector, which is, how do we build our own ecosystem without depending on a system that is, you know, intrinsically committed to destroying us? And Killer Mike talks a lot about keeping the dollars in the community. The reason that spending local and the reason that investing in local culture and not just your Netflix account or going to a local bar and not just going to Starbucks is that once you put that dollar into that local business person takes that dollar and puts it back into the community. And eventually you start to see some of that money too. That's how communities enrich themselves. If you are constantly having extraction happen in your community, if you are constantly having your cultural value and your economic value extracted by corporations, you are only giving and not taking. And so you're right, Ali, it isn't just altruism, it's self-interest to go out there and support your local coffee house or your local brewery or your local theater, because that money will be kept in the place where you live and work. And so, you know,
but we also need to modernize. We got to modernize these businesses, give them the tools. You know, there's this amazing program that came out from Minister Ng out of Ottawa, and it was called Digital Main Street. And what it was is it gave like micro grants and free webinars and tools and skills to be like, how can you take an existing business and digitalize it? We need to be able to give our local businesses and our communities, because I always go back to this, you know, the flower shop model is something I think about. We need to turn everything into a flower shop that has both an in-store and a digital mechanism. And the solution can't be these Silicon Valley companies, Uber and DoorDash, because they actually devastate the business. And their business model is so terrible that they don't even make money. I'm going to repeat this. DoorDash and Uber Eats are not making profit right now. Neither is Spotify. Their game is to grow at all cost to the point that they become ubiquitous and to the point where it's like, forget it. So we need to figure this out. We need to have a very future-oriented economy that is deeply local, and it has to be and it has to be digital as well.
But let's get to Lisa now. Lisa Berry, I'm sure you have seen her on many, many TV programs and films. And if you're a theater lover, you'll have seen her at the Stratford Festival and the Shaw Festival here in Canada. She's one of the leading actors in the country. And she's also a person who has an enormous profile as a thinker. She's got a big following on social media where she talks and thinks a lot about self-actualization and self-realization and how to make it through this fucked up life as an intact person, especially in the context of being an artist. She's one of my favorite talkers and thinkers, and we're really honored to have her. So let's get to it now. Lisa Berry on Soft Revolution. Thank you so much for doing this, buddy, considering how busy you are, which is going on in your life, because this how thing crazy. Is like blown up. I've just been watching it all morning. Me and Moya have been watching. And the first thing I want to ask about, because this is something that I think is like a real teachable thing about how much attention this festival, this program has gotten, is when it comes to theater, people like themes, don't you think? Like giving people a sense of like, you're not just going to go and see one show, but you're actually going to immerse yourself into a world of ideas that might clash against each other or be disparate, but are contained under a big umbrella, is something that I think people find really attractive about the idea of theater. It's like Coachella has to be 3 days. It's not one day, right? It's
right.
Like, and I feel the same way about this. Like, it just is so exciting that it's so ambitious.
Yeah, I think it's really great to have something that you can definitely dive into and chew the meat off the bone, so to speak, because right now we're so saturated with content. Mm. And it's all over the place.
Yeah.
So to have a theme that is being discussed is definitely welcomed.
How did this start? How did this start, Lisa? I mean, how did this come? Because it was also very secretive.
Yeah, and it was really quick.
So can you talk about the process of, you know, Obsidian and CBC getting together and then all of a sudden getting all of you incredible Black artists together and doing this in a very kind of submersive, secretive way? How'd that work?
Well, I was very, very, very fortunate to be included among some of my peers who I just admire. And it started with Mumbi had, you know, put it out there into the world and then started recruiting people. And one of the people she recruited was Ngozi Paul, who is one of my dearest friends. And she said, I want to do this with Lisa. And Mumbi was just like, oh my God, we wanted to totally do this with Lisa. Do you think she'll do it? And anytime Ngozi's like, do you want to do something? I don't even care what I have going on. I'm like, yes. How do we make it work? Yes. What is the question?
And she's pretty fabulous.
She's so fantastic. And I love just the way that she works. I love her beautiful brain and just the vision that she has for anything that she's working on. And especially with this piece in particular, I was just like, ooh, I'm excited. Because it's so hopeful, you know, it's so empowering and refreshing. The take that she has for the piece and what Luke Reese wrote was just, we were just excited from go. And we all, just every time we got off the call, because we were you know, working over Zoom, we were just always like, ooh, see you tomorrow. You know, so that was really fun. And it was just the perfect thing to be working on to start 2021, ultimately. Yeah.
I've been watching them and you're in season 2, which I haven't gotten to yet. I don't know if it's streaming yet on CBC Gem. I'm not sure I can.
Tomorrow.
Fabulous. I can't wait. One of the things that's really struck me about it, despite the fact that there's lots of, I mean, it is about the future. And so there is, there's a mythical and there's a science fiction aspect to a lot of the pieces. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really was blowing my mind this morning was how much reckoning with the past these plays about the future are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as inevitable? Like, is there a way to talk about Black futures without talking about the past?
I don't know if you want to, ultimately, because I think, you know, we can't forget our past as we look to the future because a lot of people don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think once everyone is educated, then we can entertain that kind of a question. But I was watching something on Instagram. I can't remember who said it, but it was really funny because everybody talks about why do we have to have a Black History Month and why isn't there a White History Month? And she basically was like, you know what? We actually should have a White History Month where we teach you what really actually happened. Give you your real white history.
As a white person, I'm going to vote that one down. I'd rather not talk about it for a whole month, if that's okay.
And so I thought that was really interesting because I think there's so many misconceptions around how things went and why, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, I'm really not down with celebrating Thanksgiving. You know, I really don't want to talk about Columbus Day. It's mm-hmm. really not my thing. And so to really have a re-education of what transpired in the past is really what's going to let people be able to let go of the past. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if we can let it go until we've addressed it, understand it, and clearly have made a reckoning with it. And, you know, when I did a play, Father Comes Home from the Wars by Susan Laurie Parks, it was so great to have somebody clearly say, my intention with this piece is to really answer the question, so how did we get here? Hmm. Let's talk about it.
Right.
How is it that we have these ideas? Where did this mental enslavement mentality come from? How do we break the mental chains that we have put on ourselves and continue to walk with to this day? How do we release ourselves from these shackles, even though they're not physically on us anymore? Mentally and emotionally, we are still, you know, bathed in the blood of what has happened to our ancestors. So how do we move forward? And she really does a great job of explaining it from a perspective of, let's look at it. Mm-hmm. Let's look at what we did so you can see why people made choices that they made. And I thought that was really cool. So I heard a
great interview with Zadie Smith recently where she talked about the past and about history, and she mentioned that her kid was reading Pride and Prejudice because Zadie Smith loves that book and she wanted her daughter to read it. She's 14 now. And she was saying, you know, a lot of my friends were saying to me, why do you make your daughter read this old white lady's book? And she said, because she feels like history is not, it's not about retelling history, it's about completing it. And that there are so many incomplete stories. And I was watching the shows today and I wondered about the specificity of Canadian Black futures. Mm-hmm. Because it is a very Canadian group of plays in the sense that it comes from all over the diaspora, right? There's African tradition in there, there's Caribbean tradition in there, there's mm-hmm. American African tradition in there. What do you think? What resonates about it differently to a series of plays about American Blackness to you?
Well, you know, when you think about the difference between, you know, being American Black versus Canadian Black, it's, you really go back again, we get into talking about the history. And it's so ironic because when we think about how Canadians noted their history around racism and around prejudice and injustices and slavery, we weren't as boastful. So it almost looks like it doesn't exist mm-hmm. in Canada. And mm-hmm. that's not true, as we know when you really open your eyes, because the big difference in the research that I've done is they literally kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Softened it. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying slave, they would say property. So when you look back on the history, you could think, I'm talking about a chair. And when you don't write it down that you're actually enforcing segregation, but it's just something that's known, then you don't have it in the history books as something to refer back to. But when you talk to people who, you know, are from the Nova Scotia diaspora and you hear their stories of what it was to have their lineage grow through the times, they're just like, oh, we had segregation. You just didn't write it down.
Right.
You just knew. And versus the American side of things where they were like, we all write it down because we think we're on the right side of history with this. And then we have it to look back to and go, you see how wrong you were, right? Mm-hmm. You see how there was a cognitive dissonance that you had to be living with so that you could do what you were doing because you needed something that made you feel like you were right. So you made a law that made it okay to kill people, and you gave people guns and enforced power with engaged them with power so that they can do whatever they needed to do to keep their slaves in check. And you made it legal so that people didn't think they were doing anything unethical. And then you look back at the history and you go, the big difference is they just wrote it down from a boastful perspective and Canadians didn't. Like, we still have names of slave owners as our major streets, like, you know.
Yeah.
So when you go down Jarvis, you know, or you talk about, you know, going to Ryerson, it's kind of like, oh, wow, I didn't know that those were major slave owners who were responsible for the destruction of the Indigenous community and taking away their language and their culture. And now we just don't even think about it because it's been so buried and it's been so covered, and we don't talk about it the same way that Americans do. So I think that's the big difference between the two, is we were so much more subtle about it, but mm-hmm. it was always there.
We have long had a tradition of sort of forgiving ourselves by saying we're not as bad as America for all kinds mm-hmm. of things. And I think that's part of what's exciting about festivals like this, is like recalibrating the conversation so that we begin with some acknowledgement of the fact that we are much closer to their history than we want to acknowledge, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that different ultimately. But I guess what I wanted to know too was, though, in terms of how you move forward, because a lot of the plays are about an imagined place that Black people will get to in the years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's a common destiny, or is there a different destiny for Canadian Black, particularly Canadian Black artists, I guess?
I think it's different. I think it's just like all the pieces are so unique and special in their own way. One of the pieces that really resonated with me was Dion's piece, ironically.
Yeah. Was that written for him?
I don't know if it was written specifically for him.
It felt so natural for him as an actor.
He's just a good fucking actor. Man.
He's a good fucking actor.
You give Dion anything, and it's like, did Dion write that?
But it might be. Was it in blank verse? It feels like it was in verse. Like,
And I said this to him too, and I keep saying it to him because I'm so impressed by his talent all the time. And one of the things that I think Dion does so well as an artist
is Dion Johnstone. Sorry, everybody,
this is Dion Johnstone,
who is Lisa's partner and also a brilliant actor who's been at Stratford and many other places for many years.
Yes,
sorry, go ahead, Lisa.
You know, from Edmonton to the world. So he is extremely gifted at lifting up poetic language and making it palatable so people can really hear it and understand it. And he's really good at crafting arguments. And so when you think about a piece like that, you go, oh, wow, I hear the words of may your words be seasoned with grace. Like, there are things that just really stand out. And I feel like his piece particularly just left me feeling so hopeful, because just wanting to be able to appreciate everything that he's doing now, you know, even though he's speaking from a future perspective, watching it now, like the whole magic of it all is the message to appreciate it now, because from now is where everything happens. And so I just thought it was really, really beautiful. And it's great because there was moments when it felt like he was speaking in verse, and moments where he felt like he was being super poetic, and moments where he was just coming off the cuff. And I asked him, I was like, was that intentional? Like, or did I just hear it like that? And he was like, no, that was intentional. I was like, well done. Well done, because I could.
Were you hear the poetry, or was that just an accident?
I know. I'm like, so like, how did you say?
When you did that thing where it seemed real, what was that? Yeah.
But it's so good because it's like not a lot of people can, you know, even when you're listening to people do Shakespeare, it's like not a lot of people can make you hear it as if they're speaking today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. There's sometimes another, they speak it and you're like, I don't know what you just said.
No, I want to ask you about like now. Obviously, we're aware of everything that's happened. And mm-hmm. but I want to ask you as mm-hmm. a Black artist, as a Black woman, how do you feel? How do you feel? Is it different?
No. No. I mean, you know, when everything started first really bubbling to the surface and people's platforms became filled with, you know, images and stories and conversations, I really felt it necessary to hold to what I've always used as my form of protest, which is my practice. Because I'm like, the only thing that's ever changed with everything that's happened is now you see what I've had to overcome to be the person who loves himself on a regular basis in a society that has clearly, and now you can see it for yourself, has done everything in its power to make me hate myself. So for me, I was just like, welcome to the party. I'm glad people are waking up. And, you know, I was drawn to a lot of different posts than I think other people might have been drawn to because of where I was sitting and the energy that I'm living in right now. But I found a lot of posts from like Viola, Angela Davis, who was talking about mental health and overall wellness and just reminding people that you need to take care of yourself. And if they had known that back when they were at the forefront and in their 20s, trying to make change happen, the movement would have been very different.
You mean the movement would have been, she was saying the movement would have been more successful had there been less, more self-care and more not acknowledgement of that.
Exactly. Because like, it's always going to be there, right?
Yeah.
Like this is a never ending battle. We need to constantly be moving forward and it's not going to be over in a day.
Right.
And by never ending battle, I don't mean that we're never going to come to a place where we find peace, but I do believe that we need to find peace within ourselves and be the change that we want to see so that we're able to really amplify that message, because it starts with the nucleus, you know, like in every spiritual practice that I've talked to and worked around, every single one of them talks about, you think you're spiritual? Go home. Hang out with your brother, hang out with the mother that you can't stand, hang out with your cousin who, you know, who triggers you. That's where you actually need to do the work, because how you react and how you live and move and breathe in those spaces is how you amplify in the bigger realms of our society. And so it starts with you, then it starts with your family, then it starts with your community, then it moves into bigger and bigger and bigger spaces. And so when you ask like, how do you feel? I was just like, well, I've always been pissed, but I'm not going to let that be the thing that stops me, because I need to look at life from a different perspective so that I can live it. And if I was holding to, you know, you're right, I am worth nothing. You're right, I do suck. You're right, I am Black, so I can't have nothing. Then I would be at a place when all of this happened being like, wait a minute, what? I can love myself. I can stand up for myself. And we need that out there, but we also need people who are able to be mentors and guides and healers in that circle. And not that, you know, now is the time to heal. Now is the time to go, okay, we're on the table and look at what is happening. Look at the tumor, look at the blood clots, look at everything that's happening and do the surgery that needs to be done. But we also need somebody who's able to help people navigate those feelings. Because if you're experiencing the weight of all of this for the first time, you'll get crushed under the pressure of it because it's a lot. Mm-hmm. Like we haven't seen mine yet, but you know, there are moments, you know, when I work with Ngozi where all she has to say is, see it.
Let me ask you a question, Lisa. So about C, do you feel more or less seen? Do you feel more seen now?
I definitely feel more seen. I think every Black person feels a little bit more seen.
What and does that feel like?
As a human being, seen as valued. And it feels good, you know? It feels really good to be seen as somebody, seen as a person, you know? And
did it feel weird at first? Was it like a novel experience? Was it like, wait, what's going on here? How was that?
No, I mean, like I said, like I'm in the believe it and then you'll see it. So it all right. felt very serendipitous I'm ready to receive this, you know? Mm. I think for some people it's kind of like, oh my God, you're looking at me, but you know, it's like, I feel very grateful to have a strong platform and so many supporters. But I remember when I had like 200 people following me, I said, how I am now is how I will be when there's 2,000 people following me, 20,000 people following me, 200,000 people following me, 2 million. I need to know what I stand for. Otherwise, why am I here?
Yeah.
And I really made it a point to understand what I wanted to use my platform for, so that when I was in front of more and more people, I wouldn't be guessing what I wanted to say to them. I knew what I wanted to say to them. And my message has always been, you have to love yourself. Ain't nobody going to teach you that in school, but you have to love yourself. Nothing you want can get done without you going inward and cleaning up that world so that the outside world can reflect it.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the audience. You've worked at, you know, big theater festivals here in Canada, and you know what that audience looks like. And one of the exciting things about 21 Black Futures is it's an invitation to a whole other audience to engage with theater, and it's theater mm-hmm. about them instead of theater about somebody else. Mm-hmm. But where, how does this happen for the theater at post pandemic? Mm-hmm. What do you think has to happen to bring these worlds together? Because the traditional theater audience, which skews demographically old and demographically white and demographically upper middle class, is mm-hmm. the kind of financial foundation, right, of the theater community. But the theater's going to die mm-hmm. if that's the only audience it has moving forward. What do you think is mm-hmm. the most important thing to do to bring new audiences to the theater?
Tell their stories.
Right. And that's what this is about. But mm-hmm. but past, once you've creating that work, I guess, is what I'm asking, is there a way to consolidate those two worlds, or do they have to exist in parallel universes?
I don't think they have to exist apart. I think the way that you bring them together is you give them the same opportunities that you've given the white theaters. You know, I mean, Stratford gets millions and millions of dollars in support from the government, you know, and that if you even gave, you know, Obsidian mm-hmm. a quarter of what Stratford gets as a budget, you'd be able to raise the production value of every single thing that they're doing, every production
and market
that they put
to
up,
a whole other
and be
audience,
able to market
right?
it. And yeah. so I think one of the things that is the big difference between the two is, just like you said, it is marketing.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Because
you know exactly who you want to talk
right?
to, but if you don't have the finances to actually get it into the front of the people who you want to see it, then it's like putting up a flyer downtown Toronto. Everybody who doesn't walk past that flyer isn't going to see it and isn't going to know that it exists. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be finances directed so that. To and allocate it in a way that lets them not only have high production value, but also market it, because the talent is there. That's not a question.
Yeah.
The yeah. resources are there. That's not a question. It's about sharing it. You know what I mean? and that's the big difference, I would say.
I found the whole thing very exciting because I've been so depressed about the future of live performance and so depressed about just how forgotten culture and art has been by government during all of this, whether it's understandable or not. We have been seriously put on the back burner. There is no plan yep. to get mm-hmm. us back. And so just seeing all the anxiety and all of the questioning and all of the uncertainty and the anger and the doubt and the fear that my fellow artists, no matter what ethnicity or color or gender or whatever, have been expressing through social media and on phone conversations and on Zoom conversations to each other, seeing it be that moment where like all that stuff gets put aside to make something felt mm-hmm. really cathartic to me. Like it felt really hopeful to me. Yes, there's all this pain. Yes, there's all this doubt. Yes, we're wrestling with the enormous tragedy of historical racism, but let's make something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Let's make some art.
But now is when artists need to go to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like and that's always been the case. And I think the only part that I would disagree with is I actually think because of this, and hey, let's see if I'm right. I think because of this, I think live theater is going to become a huge commodity that people want to re-engage with because we've been inside. Mm. And I think it'll be something that, you know, we'll be able to charge a higher ticket to go and see because there's nothing, and I mean nothing, like getting into a room with a couple of people, turning down the lights, and having a story unfold before you. And you be a part of that.
Yeah, the thought of watching them live was just so much more exciting to me. You know what I mean? Like they're beautifully filmed.
Of course,
and but it's just like I want to feel those actors in the room with me. You know, I want to feel it.
And you want to feel the other people in the room. Mm-hmm. Because that mm-hmm. is that's the last ingredient of any show. The audience mm-hmm. is the final piece of the puzzle because their energy shifts everything, right? And it's like, we know this, like when somebody coughs in the theater or when there's a huge eruption of laughter in the theater, it changes the show. It changes mm-hmm. the rhythm of the show because all of a sudden we have to include it. And so right now we're living in a world where nobody's having to include anything. So it almost feels like we're all living in a bubble. So when we are finally able to go out, I think things that are going to be huge are going to be live shows, theater, getting into spaces with people and feeling the energy.
You listening to this, Torque? You listening to this?
You know, I think that's just me.
You're right. I can't wait for that candy wrapper. I can't wait for the lights to go
you're
on.
Love and it.
That Werther's original. I'm going to hear that crunkle, crunkle, and I'm going to be like, oh, can you hand that to me down like four rows?
No,
it's
for real.
It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be one of those things that's going to heighten everything in a new way. And it's going to really, but I also think it's going to be something that adds a new level of presentness to our work as artists.
So art is a way out of this thing.
Oh, yeah. And live art.
Live art, because you can't replace it. You can't replace it.
I really don't think you can. I mean, I've been saying it for years and I didn't know what was going to be the catalyst that made it so. But now I'm like, here it is, folks. Mm. But I really do remember being like, you know, I think it'll be one of those things where you have such an intimate theater house. And yes, there will be lots of people who will want to stream it live and that'll be great. But then like high ticket price will be like, but I want to be in the theater.
Yeah.
I want to be in there. And I want the actor's spit to land on my face, you know, and I want to be around because it feels like community and so many of us feel alone right now.
Yeah.
And so many people live alone, you know, so.
And strangers, Lisa, seeing a stranger.
Yeah. I mean,
it's good for your psyche to be around people whom you don't know. These casual encounters, and I'm not talking sexual, these human casual encounters, studies are showing, are just as important and in mm-hmm. many cases more important than the deep ones we have mm-hmm. with those we live with and those we're closest with.
Yeah.
You've had this beautiful baby during all of this and you're mm-hmm. still working and you're still trying to do your thing. Has being a parent altered your trajectory in any way? Has it made you feel differently about where you think you might go in your life?
Oh, of course. I mean, when we found out we were pregnant, I mean, the timing of everything, you know, this kid's got such good timing. I keep thinking he's going to be a comedian. I'm just like,
seriously?
Damn, you showed up right on time.
He was very, very considerate.
You know, right when I finished my last He was so considerate. I finished my last job on March 8th. Like, I literally flew home from Vancouver on March 8th, and I was just about to go back into the audition realm. And, you know, my managers sat me down and they were just like, yeah, well, now that you're really showing, you just have to it's just going to slow chill down. Just accept it. And they could hear in my voice, you know, when I was like, okay, that's fine. I said, whatever, it's fine. I still, okay. And then literally 4 days later, they're like, everybody's on maternity leave. And I was like, right. Oh, this is not the worst thing that could have happened to me. So I didn't have to go through the anxiety of being an actor who was like feeling that FOMO of like, damn it, I'm missing out on stuff. Why can't I? I wish I could. Now I can't, you know, none of that. And so it really made me sit down and say, Lisa, who do you want this kid to meet? The world is going to hell in a handbasket and he's coming in anyways. So who do you want him to meet? And I, along with my husband, Dion, we set the intention to be the best versions of ourselves. And I would write to him in a journal and I would always say, you know, there's the only thing you can control, the only thing you have power over is how you choose to feel, how you choose to react to the situation or circumstances that you find yourself in, but you have no control over external things. So don't worry about those things. Focus on how you can feel. Focus on what you can do to shift your energy and shift what you want to experience. And that is how we're going to move forward. And we created a course together, my husband and I and myself, and it's called Breathe. And it steps through 7 principles that I really kind of would love my son to have over the duration of his life, whether I'm here or not, that he could refer back to. And I just want to
and
work
what are they?
On that.
What are they, Lisa?
And use the 7 principles that I have is for Breathe are belief, rest, energy, awareness, truth, healing, and expansion. Being able to live in those principles and create a lifestyle around feeling good, letting how you want to feel actually be the thing that you wake up and set an intention for, rather than I want to book a TV show. I'm like, well, when you say that, you're really saying you want to be able to express yourself to the fullest in front of an audience and feel good and grounded within it, in yourself about doing that. When you say you want to be able to write a book, you're actually saying, I want to be able to articulate myself and resonate with the words that are coming out of my mouth and speak to people. You know, when you say you want to lose weight, you're really saying, I want to love myself and I want every choice that I make to be a reflection of that. You know, when you change how you think about what you want from a perspective of what I want to how I want to feel, you really start shifting the way that you live your life. And then the journey gets to be a lot more fun because you're not just trying to get something. And we've all been there where you literally go after a goal and you get it and you're like, that sucks. I hate it. I don't like the people I'm working with. I don't like the job. I don't like the nothing. And everything is like poo-poo. And you can't feel good about it, even though you're like, but I got the check and I got the job and I'm in the place and I'm doing the thing, but I'm not happy. And I'd experienced that one too many times that I had to really dissect it and break it down and be like, but how can I really live my best life and not let it just be a hashtag, but actually be like, no, really, like I'm living my best life. And one of the things, you know, in the community of people that I'm fortunate enough to be surrounded by right now is there's a very big difference between the people who are looking at the world right now from the outside in versus the inside out.
Lisa Berry on the Soft Revolution podcast. Man, do I love that person. She's so cool. I wish I could see her face and hang out with her. Don't you? That's making me. It's making me miss my
beautiful
friends.
Person. Yeah. Inside and out.
I was saying before we got on the air as well that Lisa has had a baby recently. And this baby, people, you know, we all like babies. All our babies are beautiful. Everybody's baby is great. But Lisa's baby, it's a little more beautiful than your baby. I'm sorry. The competition has ended and it's Lisa and Dion's baby that is the most beautiful baby I've ever seen. Oh my God. When me and Moya, my wife, are feeling depressed, we just go on Instagram and look at pictures of Lisa's baby. And I swear to God, it is like taking a Prozac. It's just this little face. You just want it. Ugh! eat it. So thank you, Lisa, for your inspiring words. Go check out 21 Black Futures. It's streaming right now on CBC Gem. If you're out of the country, I still think you can watch it on YouTube or on Gem. I've been watching it all morning. There's some amazing work, amazing new actors that I haven't seen before. It's incredible, incredible.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like just people, I'm like, where did you come from? But also just an exciting way of thinking about the future of the theater, not just the future of Black theater, but the future of the theater, full stop. Highly recommend it. Go check it out. 21 Black Futures on CBC Gem. Okay, that's it for another Soft Revolution for another week. Ali, what's your art pick this week?
I mentioned it in the interview. I suggest everyone watch this season of This Is Us. It's I don't know. Not, some people are like against that show because literally it's pure emotional manipulation. That show comes on and I just cry to the point where I have actually downloaded even the soundtrack to it and I just play it in the background and it just like just gets me. But this season,
it sounds great, but I already have a mother. So I, you know, do I need to be emotionally manipulated any more than I already am?
No, it's really beautifully done. And this year specifically, you know, because it's crazy. They did it, you know, they had to come back and they had to shoot. And then they played COVID. They played the George Floyd protest. It's in it. So what ends up happening is that you find yourself very, not even vicariously, but you find yourself living through these people. It is a reminder. And I want to remind people of this. This has been a tremendous year.
Yeah.
This has been a tremendous year. And it's important for all of us to just step back, look in the mirror, and recognize our strength, recognize who we are. This has been a tremendous year. I hope we never have to do it again.
Yeah, man. Fuck this. Really, seriously. Yeah. It hasn't been easy, and there is trauma, and I think there will be a time for all of us to have to face just how...
Yeah.
How much trauma there has been, even the luckiest of us. And I think both of us would count ourselves among those luckiest people.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, we've lost our jobs. We've dealt with identity loss and with a sense of uncertainty about the future. And that stuff has its effect. And so I haven't watched This Is Us, but I do think there's value right now in going to some catharsis and using art to acknowledge what you've been through in some way. You know, it's an important part of getting through this. Okay, well, I'll pick some music then because you picked a TV show. I'm really, really digging a new track by a guy called Raph Rundle, who has signed to Heavenly Records in the UK. And he's about to put an album out. He's just put four tracks out for now. And there's a new one out called Always Fly featuring Terry Walker. And, you know, I'm a 90s kid, Ali. You were just, I don't even know. Did you exist in the 90s?
I thought you were 25. Yes, yes. I have to let,
you,
yes.
You may have existed.
I'm in my late 30s,
but you weren't actualized in the same way I was, Ali. You weren't.
Bro, I'm not actualized now, so I don't know what you're saying.
You weren't puffing weed as much as I was in the 90s. And this track, Always Fly, just takes me back to what I love the most about music in the 90s, which was the sound of R&B. Of the boom bap and that beautiful use of 808 drums and snares and just really slow, funky beats that you can chew on that aren't frenetic, that aren't built to work on Spotify, that just let you cruise. And this is just a great little pop tune that's been making me feel happier this week. And sometimes that's enough. Sometimes a piece of music can just serve to cheer your ass up a little bit. So
damn right.
This is my pick for this week. It's Always Fly by Raph Rundle featuring Terry Walker. That's another Soft Revolution for another week. We'll be back next week. We ain't going anywhere until at least until Ali is prime minister. At that point, we might have to call it. But before then,
see you, man. Love you.
one signal from a cue. Keep it busy whilst I'm waiting, wasting time, yeah. I got so many things I gotta do. 100 ways to try to be you now. Waiting for the signal for a cue. Keep it busy whilst I'm waiting, wasting time, yeah. 'Cause I'm lost.